From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
VIP treatment for China's President Xi at Mar-a-Lago. Hello again, I'm Aaron Alney, and this is To the Point. Donald Trump's campaign was full of tough talk about China.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing.
As president, he's talking tougher than ever, especially about North Korea, which fired another missile yesterday.
Well, if China's not going to solve North Korea, we will.
But veteran diplomats say China's essential to any possible deal. As to trade and other issues, they say this week's summit is premature. By failing to demand any concessions in advance of the meeting, did President Trump give up an important advantage? Later on today's Talking Point, Syria's latest chemical strike, the blame game continues. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Norman Olney, back with To the Point. We'll get a preview today of the potential benefits and potential risks of this week's summit meeting of the presidents of U.S. and China. On our Talking Point later, President Trump continues to blame Barack Obama for the latest chemical weapons attack attributed to Syria's Bashar al-Assad. But that was not what U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley told today's emergency meeting of the U.N. Security Council. She blamed the United Nations.
When the United Nations consistently fails in its duty to act collectively, there are times in the life of states that we are compelled to take our own action.
Soumini Sengupta covers the UN for the New York Times. Always good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thanks.
Compelled to take our own action. Was that a threat, a promise, or diplomatic speak?
It certainly was unusual. She said that at the very end of her remarks. She blamed the attack yesterday in Idlib province on the Assad regime. She said that Russia was defending that regime by blocking a Security Council resolution that would condemn the attack and ask for some other things. But it was entirely unclear what she meant by that and what she was proposing.
How was it taken by others at the United Nations? Are they as mystified as you?
She spoke at the end of the open briefing that was held. As you say, it was an emergency meeting that was held in response to the horrific attack yesterday. She held up pictures of children, child victims of the attack. This is very unusual to do in the Security Council. And she capped her remarks by this line that you quoted, that when the United Nations fails to take action, some states are compelled to take our own. And she was referring, it seems, to the 7 vetoes that Russia has exercised in the Security Council over the last 6 years on the war in Syria. So Russia has vetoed a number of measures that the Western countries proposed, including one to refer Syria to the International Criminal Court. And we'll see whether there's an 8th veto coming later today if this resolution is put to a vote.
What is the nature of this resolution, which I take it was presented in part by the United States?
That's right. It was Britain, France, and the U.S. that wrote this resolution. And it is, to tell you the truth, fairly mild in the sense that it doesn't call on any new requirements. It does not blame anyone for yesterday's attack. It does not propose sanctions against anyone. It does not say anything about war crimes or referring anyone to the International Criminal Court. What it does say is, hey, this was horrific. It says it expresses its horror at the reported use of chemical weapons. And as an aside, the Russian deputy ambassador today in the Security Council seemed to be horrified at the word horror in this draft resolution. The draft also goes on to say that the Syrian government should provide to international investigators things like flight logs, flight plans, the names of commanders who were in charge of all air operations, including in the Idlib area on April 4th. These are not necessarily new requirements. The Syrian government is already obliged to do that with a Security Council-mandated panel of investigators. And the resolution also expressly condemns the attack of yesterday and asks the Secretary General to tell the council once a month, is the Syrian government providing the information that it should be? So when this came up, the Russian ambassador very clearly said that he saw no reason to have this resolution. China was quite cross with some of the remarks that were made, but did not hint whether it was prepared to support or veto this resolution.
When you say that the Russian ambassador was horrified at the use of the word horror, what did he say about it?
His quote was, "Have you even looked at what you've written?" Something to that effect. He said that the facts were not known yet, and that this was a anti-Damascus campaign and a rush to judgment, and he did not see reason to bring this resolution forward.
Okay, so perhaps it is likely then that this will be vetoed once again. You said that there have been 7 Russian vetoes over the past 6 years. Obviously, we'll have to wait and see what happens in that context.
Yeah.
And of course, Russia and Iraq have both said that they think it was the rebels who did this attack, whether it was horrifying or not. Samini, that's all the time we have, and I really appreciate you being on our program as always. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Samini Sengupta, once again, a UN reporter with the New York Times. We'll be back. We'll hear more about this a bit later when we hear what Donald Trump had to say about it. In a moment, a preview of this week's summit meeting of the presidents of the U.S. and China on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. 2 world leaders won't be playing golf tomorrow and Friday at Mar-a-Lago, but President Trump will give China's President Xi the full VIP treatment, just as he did the leader of America's main ally in Asia, Japan's Prime Minister Abe. This weekend, the Financial Times published a sit-down interview with President Trump conducted by Washington Bureau Chief Dmitry Sevastopoulou. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Tell us, if you will, what did the president say about the summit? What does he hope to accomplish?
Well, there are a few things that were, I think, very interesting. First of all, we asked him about North Korea and to what extent that would feature in his discussions with Xi Jinping. He said it would be a big item on the agenda. And then he told us that his plan was to urge China to put more pressure on the regime in North Korea to stop its nuclear and missile programs. And he said that if China didn't do that, then the U.S. would act on its own, which is quite a big statement because that can mean many things. And it signaled, I think, that there's going to be a very interesting discussion about North Korea down at Mar-a-Lago. He also talked about trade and economics and said that those would also be on the agenda. Now, his aides have downplayed any suggestions that there's going to be some huge breakthrough on any area over the next couple of days. But President Trump himself told us that he hoped to do some kind of a big deal and that everyone should watch this space.
You mentioned the North Korea exchange right at the top. Once again, of course, North Korea fired another missile into the Sea of Japan yesterday. Here is your interview asking Mr. Trump what he expects from China with regard to North Korea.
China will either decide to help us with North Korea or they won't. And if they do, that'll be very good for China. And if they don't, it won't be good for anyone.
How ambitious do you want to be with China? Could we have to see a grand bargain that solves North Korea, takes American troops off the Korean Peninsula, really changes the landscape out there?
Well, if China's not going to solve North Korea, we will.
Dmitry Sevastopoulos, back to you. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, the problem is that that's incredibly vague, and it could mean a number of different things. On one end of the spectrum, it could mean a preemptive U.S. strike on North Korean nuclear facilities, which is something that would really worry Japan and South Korea, which are the U.S. allies in the area, because North Korea would likely respond with a barrage of short-range missiles and medium-range missiles hitting Seoul and Tokyo. But on the other end of the spectrum, it could be sitting down and talking and negotiating with Kim Jong-un, the North Korean dictator. And during the presidential campaign, Donald Trump said at one point that, you know, he would consider sitting down and having a hamburger with the North Korean leader. Now, in between, there are many different things the U.S. could do. For example, I think one thing that's on the table is the U.S. might consider placing what are known as secondary sanctions on Chinese companies and individuals who actually do business with North Korea. That's something the Chinese wouldn't like, but it would certainly send a message to China and would also jam up the North Korean financial system and their trade networks. Alternatively, or possibly at the same time, the U.S. could engage in various kinds of covert action. There's already some suggestion that the U.S. is using cyber attacks to try and infiltrate the missile program to kind of insert code that would mean that the missiles wouldn't fire properly. But there's other things they could do with cyber as well. The problem is with President Trump, he likes to say over and over again that he's not going to telegraph to people exactly what he's going to do, which means that people are left wondering and kind of speculating about a huge range of options, and we just don't know is the truth.
So these are options that occur to you and others. They are not options that were listed by President Trump as possibilities that he might take.
Well, he hasn't listed any options at all. But when he came into office, or just before he came into office, after he was elected, President Barack Obama told him that because of the progress North Korea has made with its missile and nuclear programs, and the general consensus of the U.S. intelligence community is that within the next 4 years, if not sooner, North Korea will have the ability to hit the U.S. mainland with a nuclear-armed long-range ballistic missile. Now, that would be a game-changer. The U.S. military is already prepared for the possibility that they can already do that because they have to be prepared for the worst. So Donald Trump then commissioned a review of North Korea policy, which was accelerated so that he would have options on the table by the time he met Xi Jinping. He is, I'm told, being briefed on those options this week, and I expect that some of them will be made known to the Chinese leader, probably not all of them. And then we will see, I think, over the next few weeks, it'll leak out in Washington. What did President Trump actually say to the Chinese leader? How did the Chinese respond? And over the next few weeks, we'll start to get a sense of, I think, which direction U.S. foreign policy on North Korea will start to take under Donald Trump.
Dmitry Sevastopoulos, who had an exclusive interview with President Trump. It's worth reminding our listeners that former President Obama, reportedly told President Trump that his biggest problem was going to be dealing with North Korea. So among the things that is being pointed out is that President Trump has not demanded any concessions from President Xi in advance of this week's meeting. We don't know that for sure, but it appears to be the case. Eli Ratner says that makes the summit premature. He was Deputy National Security Advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. He's now with the Council on Foreign Relations. Eli Ratner, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
What do you mean that this was premature? What sorts of concessions might the president have demanded if he had, in fact, delayed this summit meeting until sometime not so early in his term?
Well, it's premature for a couple of reasons. The first is that President Trump does not have his Asia team in place. The seats are empty at the State Department. They're empty at the Defense Department. And there has yet to be any kind of a formal process to develop a comprehensive Asia policy or even a China policy. There has been, as Dmitry mentioned, a North Korea policy review, but that's been a very narrow process on that specific issue, not on the broader China relationship or strategy in Asia. And so this meeting is happening at a time when the administration hasn't articulated where it wants to go, much less having developed an internal policy. The other reason I think this is premature, as you mentioned, is from a purely negotiating tactical perspective, these kinds of visits are incredibly important to the Chinese. This visit in particular for Xi Jinping is very much designed to portray a message of strength and legitimacy to his domestic audience. So it's incredibly important to them. The fact that it's occurring in Mar-a-Lago was clearly their preference. And the Trump administration has essentially handed over their strongest card without getting anything in return.
Did they want to have it at Mar-a-Lago because that's where the president met with the prime minister of Japan?
I think there are a couple of reasons. The first, certainly, is that it conveys a level of, again, legitimacy and respect for Xi Jinping that separates him from the other leaders that President Trump has welcomed to Washington. And as you mentioned, having Shinzo Abe, the prime minister of Japan, having been the only leader to have invited down there yet, it confers that kind of respect as well, given the close relationship between Abe and Trump, as well as the rivalry between China and Japan. So this says to the region and the world that President Trump views President Xi as an important world leader, as an important partner, and China as a great power.
Eli Ratner, formerly with Vice President Joe Biden. Back to Dmitry Savastopoulos. You said earlier that the president was being briefed this week, but if there's nobody in place who's an Asia expert and if there's no formal policy, who's briefing him on what?
Well, Eli is right that there are no no kind of top political people have been nominated for the Asia jobs at the Department of State and the Department of Defense. So what you have at the moment is people acting, career bureaucrats who are in the acting positions. In the White House, however, you have someone called Matthew Pottinger, who's actually a former Wall Street Journal reporter and U.S. Marine, who is the top White House National Security Advisor on Asia. He's playing a key role. You also have someone called Ken Juster, who's a veteran Republican economic policy expert who's doing the kind of international economic side of things. And Mr. Trump is also relying heavily on Wilbur Ross, a billionaire private equity investor, who is his Secretary of Commerce. So I think what you're seeing here is it's not clear, even when the kind of formal Asia teams are in place at the State Department and the Pentagon, it remains unclear as to whether those people will have the kind of power or influence that they might have had under the Obama administration or the second Bush administration, or whether Donald Trump is intending to kind of consolidate power or rely more heavily on a smaller group of advisors and some people who he's known for a very long time. And I suspect the fact that he's willing to have the summit with Xi Jinping now reflects that actually he's relying more on people like Wilbur Ross, who he's known for more than 30 years, and that even if you had a top Asia person at the Pentagon or the State Department, I'm not sure that Donald Trump would actually listen to them, given that he campaigned on draining the swamp and not listening to people in Washington for the last year and a half.
So, Eli Ratner, what about that? Is the president then, as we hear him say so often, doing what he promised to do during the campaign, and it just happens to be different from the way things were done in previous administrations?
Yeah, I guess my view now is that what we're seeing is an uncoordinated China-Asia policy within the administration, because I think you have not only an unconventional process, but competing centers of power. You have folks who have more of a financier, banker background, Jared Kushner and Rex Tillerson, and Gary Cohn, the director of the National Economic Council, who may be interested in more of the status quo, a less confrontational approach. You have the economic nationalists and senior advisor Steve Bannon and Wilbur Ross, who may be looking to fight harder on the economic issues. And then you have a group of folks, including Secretary Mattis at the Defense Department, the National Security Council, and some professionals throughout the bureaucracy who I would call more of the national security hawks. And these different groups want different things out of the China relationship. And I think what we have yet to see is what the trade-offs are going to be between the security issues, between the economic issues, and between the maintenance of the bilateral relationship in general. Now, I think what's going to happen at this summit is President Trump is going to lay down some markers for Xi Jinping. He's going to say, look, we want a cooperative relationship, but this isn't going to be an open-ended negotiation. And Xi's going to have to walk away from this summit thinking about to what degree he wants to come toward President Trump's demands on North Korea and on economic and trade issues. And the question will be when the Chinese come back and say, okay, we're willing to open these sectors to American investment, or we're willing to cooperate with you in this fashion on North Korea, will that be enough for President Trump? And the answer to that will be partially dependent on Trump's impression of Xi Jinping and his trustworthiness as an interlocutor, but also who among those power centers is most influential in the months ahead.
Tell us a little bit more, if you will, about how important this is to the Chinese. You said that, in a sense, President Xi has a win because he's going to Mar-a-Lago and he's been treated the same way as the prime minister of Japan, whatever he comes back with in terms of substance.
Well, Xi Jinping has a twice-in-a-decade Communist Party conclave coming up this fall at which he'll be reinstated as president, and this is going to be the culminating moment of him consolidating his leadership for the next 5 years of his reign. Now, for any Chinese president, how they manage the U.S.-China relationship is arguably their most important foreign policy parameter upon which they will be judged. And if he's seen as having been granted this sense of legitimacy from Donald Trump, effectively having tamped down some of the more hawkish elements of the Trump administration, it'll be a huge success. And I can tell you, it's very easy to imagine what the Chinese newspapers are going to look like on Saturday. They're going to be full of photos of Donald Trump casually strolling with Xi Jinping, with their families dining together, and full of statements coming out about a consensus that has been reached on a cooperative relationship and the importance of the bilateral relationship going forward. So I think the Chinese feel that they have Donald Trump exactly where they want him right now. Of course, the probability isn't zero that something unpredictable will happen, but I think considering how this may have looked in Washington, or the types of risks that may have been involved in setting their leaders up for a summit, this is about as good as they're going to get it.
Okay. Palm trees and flowers in the background, no golf. Joshua Pollack is with us, Senior Research Associate at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies at Monterey, also editor of the Non-Proliferation Review. Thank you for being on our show.
You're very welcome.
Let's take a further look at this from the North Korean point of view. And when we heard Mr. Trump say that if China doesn't deal with this, we will, how do you think North Korea is going to respond, or is responding to that?
Well, it's hard to know how they interpret it. They haven't commented on this interview yet that I've seen, and they may not do so at all directly. I was a little disturbed by one aspect of the transcript when I considered how they might interpret it. When the president refused to answer what his fallback plan was, he said, "I'm not going to tell you. I'm not the United States of the past where we tell you what we're going to hit." And he gave the example of Mosul in Iraq. So it made it sound like he might be considering a surprise attack. I don't think that's necessarily what was on his mind. He simply didn't want to answer the question. He was making a virtue of his own silence. But the North Koreans tend to interpret the United States as plotting a surprise attack against them. That's how they interpret the joint exercises that are held with the South Koreans twice a year, every year.
Let me just interrupt you for a moment, because Dmitry Sevastopoulos has to leave us, we only have 30 seconds before we go to the break. Very quickly, did you get the impression from Mr. Trump that that's what he meant, that we were thinking about what we might hit?
Not from that comment, and just to put it in context, literally about 15 minutes ago when he had a press conference with King Abdullah of Jordan in the Rose Garden, he used the example of Mosul once again to talk about how he wouldn't signal his policy on Syria. So I think this is a line he throws out, which basically means, I'm not going to tell you.
All right. Well, thank you very much with the Financial Times exclusive interview with the president for being with us on our program. We'll come back with Joshua Pollack, Eli Ratner, and others as well on our talking point later. President Trump uses Syria's latest chemical strike to criticize Barack Obama. That was what he did at the White House again today. We'll hear about that on To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney here, host of To the Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guests after the show what they listen to, they admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them you were just on a podcast of To The Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life. We're not only back with To The Point, talking today about President Trump, China, Japan, and North Korea, Asia in general. I interrupted Joshua Pollack in order to go to the break. He's with the Military Institute for Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey and editor of the Non-Proliferation Review. That's an important word, of course, in the context of North Korea. So you were concerned about the president's reference to Mosul. Dmitry responded to that. What about Rex Tillerson saying yesterday that we've talked enough about North Korea? We don't have any further comment.
Well, that was something new. And those of us who have wanted to see something new, I don't think had that in mind. Mm-hmm. But I don't quite know what to make of that. It's possible he was simply signaling that he didn't want the North Koreans to dictate the agenda at the summit. On the other hand, well, I shouldn't try to read his mind. It is very hard to interpret that kind of a silence. And putting out a statement saying there's no further comment is some kind of first, I think, from the State Department.
The possibility of a preemptive nuclear strike or strike against North Korea's nuclear facilities has been raised. How likely do you think it is that either North Korea would actually use a nuclear weapon or that the Trump administration might attack its facilities?
It depends on the circumstances. The North Koreans have indicated that the time to use nuclear weapons is when the United States launches an invasion or an attack on North Korea, because it would be their last chance to stop us. So their plans would be to attack the airfields, ports, and other bases that the United States would use in South Korea and Japan in order to avoid a replay of our wars against Iraq, where we brought in our forces in neighboring countries without interruption and then moved in on them. They've made very clear that they won't allow that to happen. As for the United States, I don't think that we have any plans to attack North Korea. I'm sure this was considered in the policy review. Doesn't sound like that option won out. The Goldilocks option, the option in the middle, tends to be what wins in these scenarios.
We did hear, though, that the U.S. is prepared to strike if, in fact, North Korea develops the capability to strike this country with a missile.
Well, we're always prepared to strike. We have plenty of missiles ourselves. When do they develop such a capability? Well, I couldn't tell you what the exact threshold is, or what are we waiting for? If that really were our policy, I think we would have carried it out. I don't think it's a good idea to attack anything in North Korea. I think it is fundamentally too late to stop this program by force, and it has been for a very long time. We could set them back, but they could rebuild, and furthermore, they could retaliate something fierce. Seoul and the rest of the region are easily within the range of their missiles, in the case of Seoul, also of their long-range artillery, and they could respond in a devastating manner. There would be a great deal to lose, even if you assume that no part of the United States is vulnerable yet.
Seoul, the capital of South Korea, of course, very close to the border with North Korea. You wouldn't even need long-range missiles in order to reach it. Let me introduce Anthony Ruggiero. He is a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. His expertise is targeted financial measures as a foreign policy tool. He's also worked on nonproliferation with both North Korea and Iran. Thank you so much for joining our program.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think are the options available to the president and other countries, South Korea, Japan, China, Russia? Is there a possibility of them all getting together and trying to work something out diplomatically with North Korea?
Yeah, I think one of the parts of the interview with the Financial Times that got a lot of play was the statement that Trump is going to go unilateral, or the U.S. will go unilateral. And I think there's been a little bit of misinterpretation there, where, you know, I've advocated for, you know, going after Chinese banks and companies. That is something that the United States can go on its own. It does not need the U.N. to do that. I think there's some areas on UN sanctions implementation that we don't necessarily need the Chinese help with. We frankly don't even have to go through the UN. There's a category of countries that wanna help and do more on sanctions, but there's a capacity issue there, and the United States and some of our allies can help with that. There's another category of countries that don't want to do more on North Korea sanctions and want to continue to cooperate with North Korea. And in that regard, there's the robust U.S. law that was passed last year, and the one that's been introduced this year that could be used, presumably once it passes, could be used to sanction those individuals. And then on the military side, not on the military attack, but on the more military facilities, you can increase the resources there. You can do more exercises. You can do interdiction exercises. So there's a lot that could be done if the Chinese are not willing to play on this issue.
Back to the question that you mentioned first, Chinese banks and companies, those would be what are referred to as secondary sanctions. How would they work, and would they damage America's massive trade relationship with China?
Sure. I wrote a piece earlier this week that really walks through what I see as, with regard especially to the banks, the four options: status quo, which I think everybody probably would agree is not really working now, the using the Treasury Department to explain to Chinese banks and Chinese companies, similar to what we did on Iran, that they need to make a different choice, that they can't continue this cooperation with North Korea, significant fines against Chinese banks, which again, we did with Iran against European banks. We fined European banks from 2012 to 2015 over $12 billion because of Iran sanctions, evasion techniques. And then the last one is a designation or a sanction of a Chinese bank, which I don't recommend because of the concerns that you outlined, which is, you know, the concern between the U.S.-China trade relationship, the concern for both economies. I think a significant fine against a Chinese bank, which there's multiple examples that they could be fined for, would categorize for them that they're not doing the right thing with regard to compliance work and making sure that North Korea is not using the Chinese financial system for sanctions evasion.
Anthony Ruggiero with the Defense of Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Eli Ratner is still with us, former advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, now on the Council on Foreign Relations. What about these ideas of using strategies similar to those that were used against Iran, against North Korea? Might that be a way to get them to give up or at least modify their nuclear program?
I think it's absolutely the most logical next step, and I agree with Anthony that there's a lot of room between doing nothing and something that would elicit an all-out trade war. And furthermore, I think this was the direction that the Obama administration was heading toward at the end of the term. And it's also, I think, what Trump administration officials, the president himself, the Secretary of State, have meant when they're talking about go it alone. Now, that is, I think, an awkward phrase because it does elicit the idea that there's going to be some kind of unilateral military strike. Any consideration of that, I'm quite sure, is quite far away from where we are now. And the next step in this process will be President Trump urging President Xi to do a better job of enforcing and implementing UN Security Council sanctions among Chinese banks, entities, firms doing business with North Korean entities. And either Xi will do a better job and satisfy the Trump administration, or he won't, and the Trump administration will have to decide, do they start walking down the path of taking some of the measures that Anthony mentioned. But that's clearly the next step in North Korea policy, and I would be very surprised to see any kind of major unilateral military action before we've walked through at least that next gate in this policy process. And I also would speculate that the Trump administration may be holding options like that in reserve, but I would be very surprised if they have laid out a roadmap that says by date certain we're going to engage in military action. They're going to pursue what they see as a comprehensive Iran-style sanctions pressure regime like has never been tried before on North Korea. They're going to try to either cajole or pressure China into being part of that, and they're going to assess the results and decide what to do from there. I think that's where we are on the policy process.
Why hasn't it been tried before? The North Koreans are a lot closer to developing a nuclear weapon than Iran.
Well, it's been the reason it hasn't been tried before is complicated. It relates to, you know, our relationship, the North Korea component of our relationship with China is embedded in a much broader set of equities. And the Obama administration was more focused on making progress on Iran, making progress on climate change, and also concerned about both Chinese retaliation if we were to take some of these actions, as well as potential implications for the global financial markets if the United States were to, for instance, in a very ham-fisted way, start sanctioning major Chinese banks that are fully integrated into the international economy in a way that wasn't the case potentially with some of the actions that was considered vis-a-vis Iran. So I think the question is, are we heading down that road? And to the extent that the Trump administration is trying to focus on the North Korea issue as well as some of the trade and economic issues, how are they going to think about the trade-offs between those? And may the Chinese, if they are sophisticated, try to get the Trump administration to walk back a little bit on North Korea by trying to enhance cooperation on the economic issues? Because it's going to be very difficult for the Trump administration to get what it wants on trade and investment and on North Korea purely through a punitive approach to China.
Anthony Ruggiero, once again today at the news conference he held with the King of Jordan, President Obama said that the Iran deal was the worst deal that he's ever seen and used that kind of rhetoric that is familiar to us from the campaign. If, in fact, he started making the same kinds of arrangements with North Korea, if arrangements is the right term, but wouldn't he be attacked by the same people such as himself who have attacked the deal with Iran?
Well, I think this is an instance where the North Koreans could save us from ourselves in that regard. The North Koreans are not interested in negotiating a deal where they're going to give up their nuclear weapons or their missile program. I mean, the best we're going to get would be a freeze, which I think is not as valuable as some people have suggested. I think robust pressure is probably the only policy option right now, hopefully getting us to that point where we could have some kind of discussions or negotiations with North Korea, but we're very far away from that point.
Joshua Pollack, when the president uses this go-it-alone rhetoric that we've heard about before, does he box himself in with that and by making what seems to be a threat, sort of like the red line issue that President Obama used at one point? Is that risky from a rhetorical standpoint?
Well, it's rather vague. He's not saying what we would or wouldn't do. You could interpret it any way you like, and I think that is by design. So I don't know if there's a plan B. I don't know if there's a fallback option where the United States can act unilaterally in a meaningful way. I don't think that any amount of pressure on the North Koreans is going to get them to change course at this point. I have my doubts that pressure on the Chinese will get them to pressure the North Koreans more than they already are, maybe incrementally. And I'm just not sure there are many good options left. So I don't know what he costs himself or gains for himself by saying that, honestly.
So, Eli Ratner, what about the business relationships between Mr. Trump, Mr. Kushner, and others associated with the president in China? Would they be an advantage, or are they potentially a disadvantage?
Well, there's a lot of speculation about the degree to which Jared Kushner's business dealings or Ivanka Trump's patents in China may be influencing decision-making. That may be a factor for some people in some way. I think these issues are much bigger than that sort of narrow personalistic aspect, and I think the debates that are going to be occurring over China policy are going to be much more strategic, and people have a lot of investment in these issues, and President Trump has a lot of political capital in both the North Korea issue at this point and in the trade and economic issue. So I think I'd like to think the strategic considerations and the domestic economic political considerations are going to override any of those more personalistic business implications.
Joshua Pollack, we don't have a lot of time left, but very quickly, if you can, tell us about Kim Jong-un. He's, of course, the young leader of North Korea. He's been very militant, very militaristic, grandson, of course, of the founder of that country. How alarmed are you by his behavior?
I am concerned that he will misinterpret the actions and rhetoric of the United States. I don't think he will do anything too rash. But there is always the chance that various armed forms of harassment of the South Koreans that the North Koreans like to engage in will escalate out of control. That's what I worry about the most.
Okay. The next thing we will see will be the VIP treatment for President Xi when he gets to Mar-a-Lago. And we'll find out what happens there, of course, as the week goes on. I want to thank you all for being with us. Joshua Pollack at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies, editor of the Nonproliferation Review. Anthony Ruggiero at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. Eli Ratner, formerly with Joe Biden's office and now with the Council on Foreign Relations, and our earlier guest, Dmitry Sevastopulo, who got that exclusive interview with President Trump. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Great to have you with us. In a moment, the blame game continues in the aftermath of Syria's latest use of chemical weapons. This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, we're not only here with today's talking point. King Abdullah II of Jordan joined President Trump today at the White House, condemning Syria's alleged use of chemical weapons against rebel areas filled with women and children. Mr. Trump repeated his claim that some of the blame rests with former President Obama.
Well, I think the Obama administration had a great opportunity to solve this crisis a long time ago when he said the red line in the sand. And when he didn't cross that line after making the threat, I think that set us back a long ways, not only in Syria, but in many other parts of the world.
Yeah, it flies in the face of what Trump said as a civilian at the time when President Obama was being told by others to take military action. David Korn is Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine. He's written about this extensively. David Korn, always good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Tell us some of the things that the civilian, Donald Trump, was tweeting at the time when Barack Obama was being told to cross that red line.
Well, I know you're going to find this surprising, but Donald Trump, who now blames Barack Obama for not doing enough back in 2013 when there was a chemical weapons attack then, at the time was calling on Barack Obama to do nothing, literally, to do nothing, to ignore Syria, to not get involved. And this is when Obama said that using chemical weapons was a red line, and he ended up negotiating a deal with Russia and Syria to get rid of a lot of Assad's chemical weapons. So I think in some ways it worked out in the end. But I have conveniently in front of me a series of tweets that I put up in Mother Jones recently from Donald Trump at this time period, when he would say things like, we should stop talking, stay out of Syria and other countries that hate us. We built our own country. Obama must now start focusing on our country. Forget Syria. Make America great again. Don't attack Syria. An attack that will bring nothing but trouble for the U.S. Focus on making our country strong and great again. President Obama, do not attack Syria. Over and over again over the course of weeks. I mean, Trump was really kind of obsessed with this idea that President Obama should not draw a red line and should not do anything in Syria. So now he is blaming Obama for having not done anything in Syria, which is not the case. But if it was, that would mean that Obama was just simply taking Donald Trump's advice. This is just one in a series of episodes in which Trump has blamed Obama for a situation that's ongoing now, but often has gotten the details wrong in blaming Obama, and then to cap it off, had a position different then that he is criticizing Obama for.
This was all in August and September, roughly, of 2013. And here's another one. If Obama attacks Syria and innocent civilians are hurt and killed, he and the U.S. will look very bad. So, again, for all kinds of reasons, he was saying, don't do anything. Is this possibly another diversion tactic by President Trump, getting us all to suddenly talk now not about him, but about President Obama?
Well, yes, because anytime he gets into a pickle or has a hard decision in front of him, what to do about Syria is really a tough, knotty issue. He's been against doing anything, and, you know, should you attack Assad for this? That would put him in trouble with his ally that he wants to have, Vladimir Putin. But anytime he gets into a difficult situation or something pushes him into a corner, like the Russian investigation, he goes out and he blames Obama, or he demonizes Susan Rice, Obama's national security advisor, or he says, how come we're not looking at Hillary Clinton, who's now a private citizen? So he is a master of not accepting responsibility, of not even recognizing that he had a different position, and just of attacking Obama. He did the same thing on Iraq during the campaign. He said Obama should not have pulled troops out of Iraq. Obama didn't come up with that deal. It was a George W. Bush deal. But if you go back to 2006, you will find Donald Trump saying again and again and again, we need to take all the troops out of Iraq. I don't care what chaos happens there next.
Are we all falling into a trap, though? You, with your article, me interviewing you on the air about it, because we're once again talking about what happened in the past, and we're not talking about the fact that what President Trump has been saying, including what he said today at the White House, is pretty vague. He doesn't seem to have any solutions either.
Well, I think we should do both. I mean, I think one reason he's attacking Obama again and again is to draw our attention away from his current problems or his current statements. He was asked again and again at that mini press conference today, well, if you think this is bad or Assad has crossed a red line, what are you going to do about it? And he essentially ended up talking about North Korea. I mean, it was a complete non sequitur. So I do think there's room to do both. But if he's going to start blaming Obama or blaming Susan Rice and trying these moves of distraction, I do think we should point that out and note his own inconsistencies. While pressing him for what the heck he's going to do now about this. He still hasn't told us on the Russian investigation how he's going to guarantee that a Russian hack of a U.S. election doesn't happen again.
He always likes to say, of course, that he's not going to telegraph his actions in advance, and that's one of the reasons he's not going to tell us anything. Let me ask you what you think of a development today, which is that the chief strategist in the White House, Steve Bannon, who has been thought of as the mastermind behind so much of what it is that Trump does and what he says, is now being removed from the main committee, principals committee of the National Security Council.
Well, it was very bizarre that he was put on the Principals Committee to begin with. The Principals Committee is made up of the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, the head of the military commands, and is really the top of the top of people who make our national security decisions. Usually political advisors, certainly not, you know, chief political strategists, are put on the Principals Committee. And it was seen as a completely odd, bizarre move when it happened. And now his departure is equally curious because we're being told that, you know, that basically mission accomplished. He was put on the committee to de-operationalize it. I'm not sure that's even a word. That was what he said. And to do this because Susan Rice had operationalized it. None of this makes any sense. We were not told he was put in that committee for a temporary reason, a temporary status for that reason. And the only time it's really been operationalized, the NSC, was when Oliver North was on it in the Reagan years, and he used the NSC to do operations to support the Contras and sell weapons to Iran that you couldn't do legitimately through the CIA and other intelligence agencies. So I don't know how they managed to do it, but they managed to make Steve Bannon's dismissal from the NSC Principals Committee about Susan Rice.
Well, they're saying, too, at least to some of the newspapers without attribution, that what he was really doing was overseeing and keeping watch over Michael Flynn, who was, of course, at the time the chair of the National Security Council, or the head of it, and that they were worried that, that he was a wild card and that Bannon ought to be there to keep track of him.
This has to be the worst cover story or explanation ever. So what they're saying is President Trump put into place a fellow to be National Security Advisor, which probably is one of the most important appointed positions in the entire U.S. government, and they had to put someone next to him, excuse me, to watch over him. That's what they're saying, that Trump's judgment was so askew that they had to put a trusted advisor next to Flynn to keep an eye on him. I mean, that is a stunning admission of institutional, incompetence, or whatever you might call it. It's actually quite frightening, if true.
What about the reporting now that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is actually behind removing Bannon, just as he is apparently behind policy in Iraq, policy in China, policy of all kinds?
Yeah, and what gets served in the White House mess on Wednesdays. There have been lots of stories coming out from the very beginning and through the campaign about power struggles in the Trump camp. And right now, we see four major figures in the Trump White House. There's Stephen Bannon, Kellyanne Conway still there, Reince Priebus, the White House chief of staff, and, of course, Jared Kushner, the White House son-in-law. And, you know, you see stories each week that seem to come from different camps dissing others about who's up and who's down. Kushner does seem to be getting more and more portfolios. Pretty soon he's going to be in charge of negotiating with aliens when they land. But really, you went through only about half of the things he's been tasked to do. A guy who's in his mid-30s, nothing wrong with being that young, but also has no experience on any of this. You know, he ran a company that he was, a job that was given to him by his father. Who does that sound like? And the fact that he's getting more and more responsibilities, is not, I think, encouraging, but certainly may show that Donald Trump doesn't have full confidence in Bannon, Priebus, and Kellyanne Conway. And, we all know people who've run family businesses, whether it's a dry cleaners, an internet business, or a real estate development. And often what they do is they put their family members very close to them, and they form a tight-knit group. Seems to be that's what Trump's doing.
David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine, the author, Trump Hypocrisy, Blaming Syrian Chemical Attack on Obama. Thanks a lot, as always, for being on our show.
Thank you, Warren.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.